It is my plan to finish up this study of verse 23 tonight. We've been studying in 1 Thessalonians 5:23. We've been basically zeroing in on the issues of God's commitment to sanctify us and preserve us. Those are the two main tasks that the God of peace has taken on himself to accomplish, and we've already looked at the details of the issues that are involved in that. And then we started looking at the issue of his statement about the spirit and the soul and the body being sanctified. And it has been, in the past couple of studies, our consideration of the sanctification of the spirit. And it is my contention, based partly on the information we'll be looking at this evening about the body, that the sanctification that God does, spirit, soul, and body, doesn't consist of fixing a broken spirit so that it's whole, or fixing a broken soul so that it's whole, or fixing a broken body so that it's constantly healthy or whatever. The issue is God doing some things to enable us to function in the truth in spite of the weaknesses of these areas, spirit, soul, and body, because of his provision above the necessity. So we can expect that God will give us a greater supply than our weakness requires. In the area of the spirit, we've seen that the spirit's basic issues of temptability have to do with its desire for approval and its fear of humiliation. And I just call that status lust and fear of humiliation. And God doesn't remove that. He redirects it in a lot of ways. We should want to be approved by him, so the desire for approval is not a false or a bad thing, as long as it's got the right person doing the approving. And the issue of humiliation at least has some play in 1 John, where he says that we should walk in the light so that we won't be ashamed before him that is coming. So those are not altogether negative things, but the spirit does go overboard with the lust for status and the fear of humiliation. People do all kind things in order to be somebody in the eyes of whoever they want to be somebody in the eyes of. And they'll go to all kinds of lengths to keep from being humiliated. We've seen that on the TV this week. Pay you $1.5 million if you'll just keep your mouth shut. Don't let anybody know what a scumbag I was long years ago. Never mind that I may still be that way. But all that is I don't want this information coming out because I'll be humiliated. He doesn't need any more money, that's for sure. So it's not about not having an income or that. It's just about being exposed, being humiliated. Well, that's the problem with the spirit of man. And in that, we've seen that sanctification of the soul is God simply blunting those lusts and fears so that we can long for the right kinds of things, and if we want to say it that way, be walking in the fear of the Lord instead of the fear of humiliation. We've also seen that the sanctification of the soul consists of God providing a real sense of security and a corollary of a real diminishing of fear, because those are the areas where the soul is weak. It wants to be secure. The idea of being safe and not being driven by the various fears that come along, because the soul is the real us. Those are the two things that threaten us the most, is our sense of security and our fears. And of course, the fear of loss of status, the fear of humiliation, those are real fears. The spirit's not the only one that has those fears. The soul fears everything anybody else in this complex fears too. So, this evening we're going to look at the third one, the sanctification of our bodies. The body is the one aspect of our temptability that is clearly declared by the scriptures to be pursued in the face of the fact that there will be no consistent lessening or amelioration of the process of death, those processes which are at work to gradually degrade our physical bodies until they're no longer able to sustain the functioning thing and we die. There's no consistent promise in the New Testament that God's going to do anything about that disintegration cycle. We can pray for health and healing when we're sick or injured. And that's fine. God doesn't mind us praying about that. But there are no promises that He'll answer our prayers in the way we want Him to. In real contradiction to the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, God made some very specific physical health promises. And you could ask Him to do them, and He would do them simply because He made those promises. But that's not true in the New Covenant, and the reason it's not is because it didn't work in the Old one. In other words, these people that were fixated on their bodies in the Old Testament could be as healthy as all get out, and they would, what the prophet very graphically says, neigh after their neighbor's wife. I mean, just like a crazy horse. Not an Indian. A horse that's lost its sense. That's what you do with good health. Use it to serve God? Nah, use it to satisfy myself. Well, for 1,500 years, the focus on the outer man didn't work. So God didn't repeat that in the New Covenant. Fixation on the outer man simply doesn't exist. The body is the one element of the spirit, soul, and body that God specifically said in Romans chapter 8 has been committed to the process of disintegration until it dies or until the rapture. And that means then that God's sanctifying work is not done in our physical bodies, it's done in our hearts and minds. And I think that's true spirit, soul, and body. I think the real issue of sanctification is in our hearts and minds, our values and beliefs. So that we don't worry about the target areas, the spirit and the soul and the body. What we're concerned about is learning and believing the truth so that the Spirit of God gives us the right values and understanding of the truth so that we love the right things and believe the right things, and that enables us to be sanctified in these areas. So, in the issues of spirit, soul, and body, God makes no promises that I can see to fix them until the rapture of the resurrection. But until then, we're summoned to be transformed by the renewing of our minds and hearts. So this evening, we're going to look at the issues of the body that we have to be aware of, because there are some issues, very practical things, that we need to be aware of in relation to our bodies, or we can be set up in terms of temptation and fail because we had the wrong value on this issue. One of the more graphic illustrations from my own past was when we were in Nebraska at one point. I had a pinched nerve in my back, and I ended up in the hospital for 3 days because it had gotten so bad that I couldn't stand the pain anymore. I was bent over, couldn't sit up straight or anything, went to the emergency room, and the doctor said something about giving me a shot of something, a power narcotic. And I said, oh, you're going to mess with my mind, are you? And he said, you've got a problem with that? And I said, not at this point. That's what I'm talking about. We can say, no, I'm not going to suffer this anymore. But we better really be careful, because our suffering may be in the will of God. And if it is, we don't want it to stop until it's time for it to stop. I think the classic illustration in Jesus' temptation in the wilderness was at the physical level, where Satan said, you're the Son of God. You don't have to go hungry. You can turn those stones right over there into bread and eat. There is no sense to this. You're senselessly starving. You can solve this problem yourself. There's stones right there. You can turn them to bread. But Jesus taught his disciples, and you've heard this before, but he taught his disciples that you should pray, give me this day my daily bread. And he taught his disciples that when you ask for food, any good father will not give a stone in the place of bread. So Jesus said, okay, I've asked for food, didn't get it. The devil's saying, I can turn these stones into bread. That's not the Father's will. Can't possibly be. What father among you would give a stone to a son that asked for bread? Can't be. So what did he do? He went hungry. Well, sure, he got old. 40 days and 40 nights, he got old. And I'm sure that he was hungry. And I'm sure he was suffering a lot of things because of it. But every day that he asked for daily bread and didn't get it, he knew that he was being tempted to do something in violation of the Father's character in order to solve a physical level problem, and he wouldn't do it. And thanks be to God that he didn't do it, because our entire salvation hinged on whether he did it or didn't. So what I'm saying this evening is that our bodies can be tools of temptation that can be used to defeat us. So I want to start this evening by addressing the issue of the true nature of the body, and in order to do that, we're going to have to get out of 1 Thessalonians, because he just mentions the body here. But in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, he uses three terms that I think are a succinct summary of his concept of the body. 2 Corinthians 5, he says in verse 1, "We know that if the earthly tent, which is our house, is torn down, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." He said, "In this house we groan." And then in verse 4, "Indeed, while we're in this tent," that's a tabernacle, "we groan, being burdened, because we don't want to be unclothed, but to be clothed, in order that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life." Now, the issue there is, he calls it an earthly tent, a tabernacle in a sense. He talks about it in verse 1 as a house that might be torn down. And then he talks about a building from God. So when we think about the body and its purpose in God's plan for us, the term, the basic term, is a house. If this house, in this house we groan. I think the word house must be in italics there. I think that's what my glasses are telling me. Not, must not be in the original. But anyway, he's talking about this dwelling place. And that's what a house is. An oikia, a house. But the problem with the issue of the house is that it's really generally used. It sometimes means the building. They went into the house. It means the building. Sometimes it's the people that are living in the house. So that he and his house were saved? Well, it wasn't his building. It was his family. And then you have the larger concept of the whole group of people that function in the house, which could include household servants or slaves or whatever. So it could be a household of people, the people dwelling in the building. So sometimes the building, sometimes the people dwelling in the building, sometimes the family of the owner of the building. That's the way the word house is used, and that's a pretty big general thing. And when you look at your body and you say it's a house, fundamentally that means you're dwelling in this. This is your dwelling place. But that's not real helpful in a lot of ways. So we go to the next term that he uses, a tabernacle. And he adds the concept of a tabernacle. Now, the word tabernacle, translated tent, tabernacles the way they used it. They built these little tabernacles for the Feast of Tabernacles, and they dwelt in them, and they were basically temporary housing, kind of tent-like or perhaps brush arbor type or whatever. But nonetheless, they called them tabernacles as a temporary dwelling place, and that's what a tabernacle was. So it's a tent or some kind of a movable dwelling that you could take with you, and nomadic people did that. They lived in these tabernacles or tents. But twice in the scriptures in the New Testament, in Acts 7:44 and Revelation 15:5, there's this reference to the tabernacle of the testimony, the tabernacle of the witness, the martyria. And both of those references are back to the tabernacle that was built in the wilderness that was the dwelling place of God in the nation of Israel until they built the temple. So the tabernacle was a house for God, but it was a temporary or movable thing, and that's what gave David some quandary when he wanted to build a temple, because he saw himself living in a castle, and he looked out there and God was living in a tent, and he knew what living in a tent meant. It meant you could pack up tomorrow and leave. And he also theologically knew that that's pretty much what God had done with Saul. He had abandoned him. He took the kingdom away from Saul, rejected him as king over his nation. In effect, God packed his tent and hit the road. He said, "You don't want to walk with me? I'm out of here." And more or less, that's what Ichabod meant. And not Ichabod Crane, but Ichabod. It meant the glory has departed. They actually saw the Shekinah lift up from the temple and leave. Well, David was bothered by the fact that God could, you know. So he thought he'd build a permanent house and maybe they'd keep him around a little bit longer. I don't know what all his musings were, but I do know that when he was contemplating that, God said, "I'm going to build you a house. And your offspring will sit on your throne forever." In other words, you don't have to worry about me packing up and leaving. I'm going to even make sure you don't pack up and leave. In other words, I'm going to underwrite your faithfulness and your progeny, your offspring. And ultimately that came down to Christ as the Son of David. But the key thing there is it's called the tabernacle of the testimony. And I believe that's really the key issue to the body. Because when you put it all down in just basic terms, people can't see a spirit and they can't feel it. I know, you know, Ghostbusters, they always talk about this cold place or this kind of breeze went by or, you know, whatever. But spirits really don't have much to do with any of that kind of temperature drop or whatever. Spirits are spirits. You can't feel them. And that's one reason the demons were so adamant with Jesus about not being cast out of a body unless they had another body to go into, because they were going to be restricted from being able to mess around in this physical creation unless they had a body to manifest themselves through. That was the ultimate purpose of the body, is to manifest the spirit that's dwelling in it. So if the spirit has a body, it can wave hands and talk and its eyes can flash and it can make faces and it can do all kinds of stuff. And that means that people can look at the body, watch the body. It's a witness of the spirit that's in it. The tabernacle of the testimony. Your body is how people get to know you. Because without a body, you can't talk. Without a body, they can't see you. You can't do anything, so they can't observe your behavior, so they can't make any conclusions based on what they're seeing. But that's how you get to know people. Now we have long distance communication, but what if people didn't have fingers and they couldn't type, and then you couldn't have Twitter or Facebook or any of that kind of stuff, because they don't have fingers, they can't type. So you say, "Well, I'll call them on the phone." You can't hear or speak without a body. So everything about the physical body has to do with it's a tool. It's to manifest the spirit within it. And that's exactly what it says in John chapter 1. Before we get to that, though, let me mention the other buttressing term. It's a house, a tabernacle, it's a building of God. And that word for building simply means something that's in the process of being stacked brick upon brick until you actually have a dwelling place. It's a building. It's something that's being built up. So I draw from that comment that it's a product of God's piece-by-piece assembly of our body suitable for the tasks that require the body in order to be able to be accomplished. In other words, the psalmist says that God knit our bodies together in the womb. And all the while he was knitting that body together in the womb. Of course, the scientists all say God wasn't even there. These cells are dividing and the DNA is controlling and all that kind of stuff. But they've just written God out of the picture. The scriptures have it right. God may use DNA coding and all that, but it's still God doing it. And as a consequence, every body being built in the womb has some kind of a goal in mind, and God's thinking about how this body is going to be used in his creation. Now, he may let it run amok with a spirit that's degenerate and refusing to believe or anything, but nonetheless, he has a task in mind, and it's the fundamental task of the body is to manifest the person that's going to be dwelling in it, spirit and soul. So the conclusions that I draw are two. Number one, the issue of the tabernacle is the issue of the body as an instrument of revelation, because John 1:14 says that. John 1:14 says the Word became flesh, it means took on a body, and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. That's the whole point. We could see Him because He took up a body that we could see. So we could look at Him and we could watch Him and we could listen to Him and we could see Him and we could understand what the glory of God is all about in a very practical demonstration, because this is the tabernacle of the witness. The Spirit of Jesus was in the body of Jesus, and the body was the tabernacle of the witness about the Spirit that was in there. And as a consequence, we know an awful lot of truth about God simply because of what Jesus did while He was here, and people observed it and recorded it. So I really believe that the body is an instrument of revelation regarding the one that's dwelling within it. And that's the reason why we're told to walk by the Spirit of God, so that people can see the Spirit of God producing the life of Jesus through our bodies, so other people can see the truth about God through our bodies, just like Jesus' body was an instrument of revelation for Him. So that's the issue. The concept of the house as a building seems to be that God is deliberately indicating that He's the architect who builds people toward objectives that have already been established. And in this text, the objectives have already been established as kingdom, service, inheritance issues. He is sanctifying you through the process to a certain telos, and he's preserving you through the whole process to an inheritance. So kingdom, task, inheritance, that's what's in mind, the sanctification of the body. So God is actually He put our bodies together and then put us in them so that He could accomplish His long-range goals of preparing us for His kingdom service. That's what our bodies are all about. And that's what makes the body such an issue, because if the body is led astray into behavior that is a denial of the truth about the God who made this body and the person who dwells in it, then the whole theology is corrupted by sin. That's what temptation's all about. It's corrupting people's knowledge of God by causing misbehavior in the lives of those who claim to be the children of God. The theology is dictated by the behavior they observe. The final measure of any person is not what they say, but what they do. Everybody knows that. They listen with one ear, but they watch with two eyes. And if they see a contradiction in the behavior, it doesn't matter what their mouth says. The evidence is in. We've seen him. He's a hypocrite, whatever. But by the same token, if they see somebody who lives out what he professes to believe, they say, we have a valid declaration of the truth here. Because he says this and he does it. And that's what was going on at the cross when the centurion said, surely this was the Son of God. How did he decide that? Well, watching him die. Listening to what he had to say and watching how he handled himself. So, I really believe that the building issue is of God indicating in this context that God is the architect building us toward the objectives that He's had in mind for a long, long time. So, the concept of this house, this body, is a concept of humanity, and its basic makeup. So, we're even promised a house that is eternal in the heavens, according to 2 Corinthians. And therefore, we conclude that though we are fully conscious and aware while we're out of our bodies, between physical death and rapture resurrection, while we're out of our bodies in that setting, there is a true awareness, a true understanding, true participation to some degree in the issues of paradise where we are in the presence of God. But we are not fully human until the resurrection. We will be restored to the fullness of our humanity when we are reunited with a glorified body. So even in eternity future, we're going to have bodies that are going to be tabernacles of witness. They're going to be telling people about the Spirit that's dwelling in them by the things that are done. So, that raises this issue then. Where is the body most susceptible to being led astray?
The children of God are to be sanctified with a goal in mind and an inheritance in mind. And this should be visible to the people who are observing God's working in their life. They should be able to see believers who are doing and things that are demonstrating their characteristics and so forth for a future in the kingdom. And therefore, to get the body to be abused by the spirit that's dwelling in them is an attempt to destroy the good theology that is developed by observing people who profess to know the truth. That's Satan's objective. So in both Eve's case and in Christ's case, they were both tempted to use their bodies to eat something that was not a legitimate food. And the very fact that they were tempted to eat means something about the physical body. And that is this. If the body had a mind of its own, it would have a fixation on preserving itself. Because the body has a way of letting the spirit that's within it and the soul that's within it know when it's running out of water and running out of food. It has ways of letting you know that. And if you ignore it very long, it has ways of making you where you can't ignore it any longer. The longer you go without water, the more you realize you need some water. And the longer you go without food, the more you realize that you need some food. And that's just the body's way of saying, look, I'm important here and you better feed me and water me. Self-preservation is one of the fixations of the physical thing called the body. And that means then that in the temptation where Eve and Christ were both tempted to eat something that wasn't legitimate food, the fixation of the body on self-preservation, feed me, give me something to drink, give me something to eat, I'm going to die here, you don't want me to die, you won't be able to express yourself if I die, you better take care of me or I'll, you know. That kind of demandingness means that there is something very dangerous about the body's demand to be put on the top shelf. And that's all the body cares about, is being up there where its needs are being met. I got all I need to drink. I got all I need to eat. I'm doing good. And as long as you keep me up here on this pedestal and meet my needs, you'll be all right. Well, obviously, especially in Christ's case, I don't think Eve was ever in any danger of going hungry. She had so much food around her to eat, there was no way she was ever hungry. Unless she just chose not to eat. But something about that, with Christ particularly, the issue of maybe this particular behavior to save the body's physical well-being is illegitimate. Isn't that what torture is about? Trying to force you to do something that you don't want to do by making your body hurt really bad. And if a person says, well, you know, God doesn't want my body to hurt real bad, so he must want me to do this thing that I'm being forced to do. And that's the rationale that leads to sin. Jesus could have easily said, well, you know, God doesn't want me to go hungry. He's given me the power. I can turn these rocks to bread. I can do that. For the Son of God to turn a rock into a piece of bread would have been absolutely no problem. It would have been a great Z miracle. There's nothing to it. But he wouldn't do it. Sometimes it is the will of God that our bodies not be the dominant demander. And therefore, we can say this about it. The temptation of the body comes right out of its self-preservation fixation. Now, basically, self-preservation is basically a neutral issue morally. Because the issue is simply keeping the body alive. There's nothing wrong with the body wanting to stay alive. Nothing wrong with wanting to keep your body alive. Nothing wrong with going to a doctor when your body's sick so that you can make it healthy again, if the doctor has enough sense to give you the right kind of stuff to make you healthy again. But if he doesn't, there isn't anything wrong in seeking ways to make yourself healthy. There's nothing wrong with it. It's neutral. So that means that we have to look in a couple of other areas, and all of us are aware of two other major areas where the issues of the body are not neutral. self-preservation may be neutral, but the body in its self-preservation mode is pretty committed to something beyond self-preservation, and that commitment is to pleasure. That's the only thing that you can really assume about Eve wanting to eat that fruit. It didn't have anything to do with preserving her life. It had to have some kind of appeal that it might taste better or something along that line. So there's a pleasure principle, and the body is so committed to that that in a situation of satiation where you don't have any real problem with being really, really hungry, I mean, necessarily, you know that if you put genuine, legitimate food in your mouth, but your taste buds don't like it, you know what you will do. I'm never going to eat that. Well, your body is spitting out the very fuel it needs to keep it alive. Why? Well, it doesn't taste good. Well, what difference does that make? Well, it's all about pleasure. I ain't going to eat something that makes me spit. I'm going to eat something that makes me, that was good. And all that tells us is that the body's commitment is not just to self-preservation. There's another commitment. That's to pleasure. And when you stop and think about it, pleasure's a pretty potent driver. That's the root. And the bottom line, that's the root of multiple human problems, the desire for pleasure. If you've ever had real strong painkillers that made you feel like you were in heaven already, you already know what I'm talking about. It scared me when I was in the hospital and I felt like, man, I have never felt this good in all my life. I know why drug addicts are drug addicts. It scared me enough to where I was pretty leery about ever getting too tied to that, because I didn't want to ever be tied to something just because of the pleasure pull. So, that's one side of the issue. The commitment is not just the neutral commitment to stay alive, but it's the commitment to stay alive in a pleasant setting, pleasurable setting. And that goes simultaneously with the alternative. The body is also pretty deeply committed to escaping from pain. And we all know this because of the rapidity of our reaction when we're hurt. You touch something hot and your hand comes back like that, automatically, you don't think about it, just do it. Your body's saying, ow, that hurts. And across the board, pleasure and pain are the two big deals. The body has actually been built in to make pleasure a summons and pain get away from here, get away from this. Don't do that again. Pain is a desirable warning. You know, leprosy kills the nerves in your flesh so that you can't feel pain. And a lot of the problems with leprosy is that people do damage to their hands and feet and face and all because they don't realize that they're doing damage because they can't feel it. If you have leprosy in your hand, you can reach down and pick up a burning coal and not even realize that it's hot because you don't feel it. But it's still burning the skin right off your fingers and burning into the meat. And as a consequence, you get all this infection and everything. So all I'm saying is, pain's not a bad thing, pleasure's not a bad thing. But an overcommitment to either one of them can lead a person to do things physically that they ought not to do simply because it's the wrong thing to do at the wrong time. So the issues of pain and pleasure are not of themselves evil in any sense. There's a significant level of evil only when those commitments to pleasure and escape from pain drive us beyond the boundaries that God has set in place. And right here in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, Paul said, sanctification is the will of God for you, so you need to learn how to handle your body, especially in areas of sexual pleasure. That's the big issue in chapter 4, is how to handle your body, and not in lustful passion, but not engaging in sexual immorality. Does that mean God doesn't want us to enjoy sex? Yes and no. He wants you to avoid it if you're not married. No, He doesn't want you to avoid it if you are married. There are certain boundaries. Well, the same thing's true then with the issue of pain.
Does God just want us to hurt just for the sake of hurting?
No, that's masochism or whatever you want to call it. That's just dumb. But there are people who think they're more godly if they inflict pain on themselves. And when we were in Mexico with the young people, or maybe it was when we were with Larry and Jamie. But anyway, when we were in Mexico, we went to one of the big cathedral things, and we saw these poverty-stricken peons crawling across gravel on their knees, ripping the skin and all that, because they were gaining some kind of merit in the eyes of the God who was going to be in that church or whatever. The whole point there is, God's not interested in that. The only time He's ever interested in us enduring pain is when to not endure it would be a violation of a greater good. For example, the one I mentioned earlier, martyrdom or torture. If somebody says, "You deny Jesus, or I'm going to break your fingers." Well, that's going to hurt big time. So, what's your answer? You're going to deny Jesus, or you're just going to say, you know, not an easy decision, but God doesn't want you denying Jesus, so. There are times when pain is a strong temptation to do evil. So is pleasure, a strong temptation to do evil. So the reason that Paul is dealing with this sanctification of the body is because he already did in chapter 4. Obviously, that's a big problem, sexual misconduct. But culturally, we need to see how this works out. And we have a classic example in the sexual area. You have this, what they call, LGBT movement? That's a lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender. Is that it? All right, I got all four of them. Well, they'd love to know I'm talking about them tonight until I say what I'm going to say. But the fact is, the LGBT movement started out as nothing more or less than sexual pleasure taken whenever desired with whoever you desire. No restraints. Just, if you want to do it, do it. Okay? That's the way it started out. Don't let anybody misguide you about love and all that kind of stuff. It's just a sexual pleasure thing. That's all it was when it started. That's all it is ever. Except that now it's more. Because it moved from that to wanting not to be persecuted for that. They've got this little gay boy now on TV saying, "I'm being bullied and I'm being called queer," and yes, and on and on. And what are they trying to do? They're trying to get people to quit saying bad things about people that are sexually deviant. What's that? It's a desire to not be persecuted. So it went from sexual pleasure to, now don't harm me for my indulge myself in pleasure. And then what did it morph into? Not only do you, I don't want you not to persecute you, I want you to make sure that you say what I'm doing is perfectly fine. So it went from just raw sexual appetite to the desire to not be persecuted for that, and now they want to be approved for that. So this is a total body, soul, spirit reality. The body wants the sensual pleasure. The soul wants to squelch the persecution because it doesn't like insecurity issues. And the spirit wants to be approved. So this is a total body depravity. It's in direct opposition to God's sanctification of the spirit, soul, and body. And the reason is because God created us as physical creatures with a body for a purpose. He wants us to make the truth about Himself known by the way we act, by the things we say, the actions we take, and all of that. If we distort the behavior in evil ways, going beyond the boundaries, we're distorting the testimony of God that is supposed to be coming out of the tabernacle of the testimony, our bodies. So, that's why Paul says, now may God Himself with telos in mind and with inheritance in mind, sanctify you completely. That is, your spirit, your soul, your body, and then preserve until that inheritance without blame at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, God willing, and they don't have another cattle move, we'll go into verse 24 next time about God doing this. Comments or observations?